when we look at this model of the mind for the Buddha, we've got categories of states of mind that are completely neurotic, delusional, disturbing, deep mental illnesses, in other words. And basically he is saying, and he would have liked all these terms, we are all mentally ill. As long as you're, quote, in samsara, unquote, which means caught up in these neuroses, you have serious mental illnesses. And this is the tragedy in our culture. We think they're normal. I mean, it's just kind of depressing, isn't it? If Buddha's right, we have an extremely depressing view, that it's normal to be angry, it's normal to be depressed, it's normal to be jealous. We only think you're abnormal when it's serious, you know? He's more radical than that. Really, so it's quite interesting to think about. And that the key two main functions of these neuroses, which in their nature are distinct and separate from and can be distinguished, which is the job of being your own therapist, from the positive states of mind. We give them equal status, you know. A normal person's got a bit of anger, a bit of love, a bit of jealousy, a bit of depression, a bit of kindness, hopefully more of the good than the bad, we hope, but that's about the best we can achieve, we think, you know. He's way more outrageous. He's way more radical. So the job is to distinguish internally, experientially, between these two collections of states of mind. And that is not an easy job. Because when we have attachment for a person, it's only for the person we have love for. Love is a virtue. Love is may you be happy. Love is altruistic. Love is marvelous. Love we can grow to the nth degree. Love is at the core of our being. Love is positive. But we can't tell the difference between love and attachment. This is our trouble, you know. We practically think they're the same. And reason is because we only love those we're attached to, and we're only attached to those we love. It's really difficult to see. We never distinguish, you know. We'll talk more about this later. Let's keep on, stick to emptiness. So all these neuroses have this general function. They all share the same function of embellishing what's there. Simplest way to put it, of exaggerating, of adding on to things. As Lama Zopa says, the delusions decorate on top of what is there layers upon layers of characteristics that just aren't there. So it's you know, when we hear that we don't see reality, we kind of get confused what he means by that. It means this. So we do see cakes and toilets and people and things and selves and blah, blah, but we put all these bells and whistles on top and we can't see that we do that. That's the part that's tricky. And you'll never do it. You've got to first be intellectual, be clear the words, then you can only do it by being internal. Only do it by going deep inside your mind. And it's a very rigorous, disciplined, intelligent job, not some space out job, you know. So, of course, the subtlest, the most primordial delusion, the one that informs all the others, is this one called ignorance, or known colloquially as ego grasping. Very tasty. So let's look more at how we cling to this I that Buddha says doesn't exist, and how we search for that I that doesn't exist among the bits and pieces of me, which is where we think it exists. So if I say there's no tea, you've got to say, where is there no tea, Rabina? Won't you? Well, there's no tea in my cup. You've got to be precise. Where, there's no money. Where is there no money, Rabina? In my bank account. So you've got to know where there is no something. Can you hear that idea? And so you turn there is no money into a phenomenon, into a noun. The emptiness of money. So we'd say, oh, it's not red, but turn it into a knowable, hear the words, turn there is not no red, it is not red, or there are no dollars, there is no inherent self, turn those terms into nouns, into knowable phenomena. And that means you turn it into the word emptiness of money, emptiness of red, emptiness of inherent self. Can you hear that? That's why they talk about we have to realize emptiness. How emptiness, like red, is a phenomenon that does exist. It seems abstract to us, and we hear it in a negative way, but it's like saying a minus number and a plus number. It seems a bit silly, but mathematicians understand it. You get what I'm saying? So a negative number is minus two. A negative statement is a non-affirmative thing is there's no, you know, the emptiness of money. But it's a vivid thing when you understand that if you think there's £10,000, the thing that you do see in the bank is the absence of £10,000. Can you get that idea? Got to get your head around this. It's quite subtle, but it's really meaningful when you get it, rather than just thinking, oh, it means there's no I. It means there's no money. Not like that. It's more nuanced. Can you hear me? What? Well, I suppose. Keep it quick and sharp and focused.
So when we try to realize emptiness of a phenomena, so is it enough if we just realize emptiness of one phenomena and that's going to kind of pervade
or
other?
You've got to do one at a time. You can't look at emptiness of tea in more than one cup at a time, can you?
No.
One at a time, dear.
So can you realize, by realizing emptiness of cup, can you realize emptiness of other phenomena?
I answered your question. Think about it. Okay. Think about it. You'll get the answer yourself. You've just been clever. He's a clever boy. He's obviously studying all this. Are you not? You don't study it. You don't read it and think about it? Well, good then. So then if you think about it, you'll get your answer. Who's supposed to give me the answer today? Where is she? She didn't come back. She got nervous. Oh, God. Okay. So, okay, let's go more. Let's start to see, because what Buddha's saying, come here, Abina, give us a break. There is no inherent I in there, darling. So we're not going to believe him because we just completely believe there is. So he says, okay, then kindly search for it. And this sounds hilarious to us, you know. So let's see how we do that. So where you're going to search for the I, where would you search for the I? Where would you search for no tea? In a cup. Where would you search for no money? Where would you search for no I? On the parts here. So this is how they talk. You've got to establish the term for what exists. One of them is established base. So these bits and pieces coming together is the base, right, for the name I. Would you agree with that? This clay here, all the bits, is the base for the label cup. This is a crucial way to talk. When you really understand emptiness, like Lama Zopa when he's a little boy, Lama Zopa, our boss, you know, he's a Sherpa. And he was recognized as a little boy as the reincarnation of a previous Nyingma yogi called Khunsang Yeshe, who's a layman, very humble, like a lot of these practitioners, who spent the last 20 or so years of his life in a little cave up in the Sherpa land, you know, up in Solukhumbu. So apparently there was this little hole in the wall where they stored the radishes. Or the onions, I never know which one. And the term in Sherpa country, Sherpa language, is laudo. So this little hole, he decided to pull the radishes out and moved in, you know. So that's where he got his home, and he said that Guru Rinpoche offered it to him. So he got known as the Laudo Lama, the radish Lama, you know. Anyway, he spent his last 20 years, last life. And then the story goes that he, like these great Vajrayana yogis, they can go through the death process with complete control, and they can choose their next rebirth. They're in control of the whole process. You know, they don't lose the plot at all. So he got born, it says, as this little person called Zopa. And his sister said, since he was born, no one knew who he was initially. He says he could crawl. The moment mummy turned her back, they'd find him crawling up the path to the Laudo cave. And the moment he could talk, he's stomping up the hill. Come home, mummy would say. No, he'd say, that is my home. So these little reincarnate yogis, they're said to retain their memory because they've controlled themselves through their life, through the death process. They don't lose the memory, you know. But they also, as they get older, they kind of, it recedes a bit in the background. Anyway, his sister said every time he played games, he always played the role of being the lama. He'd sit there and he'd make mud pie dorjis and mud pie bells and mud pie torma cakes. And he would announce he was going to invite all his benefactors to the puja. And he'd list all the names, all his previous life benefactors, you know. So his mummy thought she'd better check up with a local lama. And they did their divinations, and they how they do it, and they came up with the conclusion, yes, he must be the reincarnation. So he got known as little Zopa Rinpoche. Anyway, when he was 8 years old, he told this story. He's up in some mountain monastery somewhere, and there's this great big fat river. And on the other side of the river, he sees this strange, pale-faced, blue-eyed, straw hair-coloured people, white people, basically. And he wanted to go meet them, you know. Never seen these strange people before. So he wants to go across this rickety bridge with his bowl of potatoes because you've got to bring a gift. But his manager didn't. They're very professional, these people. He has a manager, you know. These little reincarnations are given managers. So his manager I was nervous and said, don't go, but he insisted. He was very stubborn. So he went across the bridge with his bowl of potatoes and he fell in the river. Well, of course, they don't teach him swimming up there. So he's drowning, right? And how he told the story is this, and this is, I'm getting to the point. He said, the head was bobbing up and down for air, right? And he saw the manager frantic and running up and down the bank. And then he said, the thought occurred to me that the person known as the Lao Tzu Lama is about to die. And then he said, I didn't know anything about emptiness, which means up to that point, since 8 years old in this life, he'd heard no teachings, but there was no fear. So we can deduce from this statement, actually, that he had realized emptiness. It was in his mind and he hadn't lost the plot. Because that's how you talk when you realize there is no I, inherent I, among these parts. So this is a discussion we have to talk about, look into, you know. They've got, so he, they say, as Rinpoche says, when you realize emptiness, there's no fear. And this is what's interesting, remembering I said this yesterday, if we look at this model of the mind and look at the structure, this hierarchy of these delusions in our mind, you will not find one called fear, which is fascinating for us because that's one of the major ones we talk about. But the reason is simple, because all these delusions, in particular the root delusion called ego grasping, are in the nature of fear. That's their main voice. You look at your mind. So I'm a constant state of worry, panic, anxiety. Look at a person when it's angry, they're having a panic attack. Look at a person who's depressed, it's beyond bearing. Look when attachment doesn't get what it wants, you're like hysterical. It's fear, they're all fear. And of course we can't conceive of having no fear. So Lama Zopa's story, if you told that to a materialist, a scientist, they would say he had instinct for survival. An instinct for survival, which is a great word Buddha would again like that, for ego grasping. Because the point is, normal person who's got ego grasping and attachment would have total panic in their mind, wouldn't they? We know ourselves, you nearly have a car accident. You're completely hysterical. We lose all common sense. Fear completely takes over. We become paralyzed. Because, the Buddha says, we have ego grasping. And that really is a great term for this other one, instinct for survival. So then we think in the West, well, if he didn't have that, he would have sort of sunk to the bottom of the river like a stone and go, oh, well, I'm drowning, doesn't matter. Rubbish. He still tried to go to the surface for air, but the shocking point, which we can't imagine, because he had no instinct for survival, ego grasping, therefore no attachment, therefore no anger, therefore no jealousy, therefore no panic and drama, and therefore no fear, therefore the mind was clear and wise, crystal clear, no difference, no change. But he's dealing with the situation, but not out of fear, out of just common sense. But the mind is stable. This we can't conceive of, but this is what Buddha says is possible. Because all delusions are in the nature of fear. When you've unplugged, pulled out, uprooted, argued with, seen the lie of ego grasping, there is no fear. And that's what he said. So he's implying he already had realized emptiness. And that's how come he said, the person known as the Lao Tzu Lama. We just go, I am drowning. So this is where, and it sounds so intellectual to us and so kind of meaningless, all the discussion you have to have about exactly what is the I, how does it exist, and therefore to search for it. So it takes a lot of clarity and a lot of intellectual understanding and a lot of purification and a lot of practice to even be able to do this. Because we don't even know what it means. I, inherent, not I, parts, this, that, aggregates. Just confusion to us because we're not used to thinking this way. So basically, you think, look at our language. I did that. I nearly drowned. I have anger. You did that to me. So without analyzing it, it's correct. It's without analysis, it's a correct statement that I am sitting in a chair. It's a correct statement. It's a correct statement that is a cup on that saucer. Without analysis. But what Buddha says is, we've got it right conventionally, but if we analyze it, it's riddled with mistakes. This statement is riddled with misconceptions. It's riddled with wrong assumptions. And that's what we have to unpack. So, basically, one of the ways of looking at it, one of the cups of arguments, you know, we say, I have a nose. That's two things we just mentioned, isn't it? I is one thing, right? And nose is another, isn't it? So normally speaking, if you say there are two things, you'd have to separate them, wouldn't you? If you say you have $2, £2, you've got to point one coin there and then another coin there. And they wouldn't be the same coin, would they? Unless they're a £2 coin. You get my point. They'd be two separate individual coins. And you're trite to say you've got £2. Yeah? You agree with that? Okay, good. My table, keep it simple, has a thermos and a bowl. Do you agree? Have a look, please. So why do we know that's true? Because we've all agreed the label thermos, we've agreed the label bowl, we've agreed the label table, we've all proved it to be true, we know the bowl is that, we've all agreed, we've signed off on that, we all accept these are conventional statements of truth. So if it's a true statement, my table has a thermos and a bowl, it's obvious I've got to point out three things, don't I? I've got to point out a thermos that is not a table or a bowl. I've got to point out a table that's not a bowl and is not a thermos. And I've got to point out a table that is not a bowl. I said that before. You get my point? You get my point? Three separate, individual, distinct phenomena. It's simple mathematics. You agree? Okay. I have a nose and a foot. You agree? You agree? Okay. So we have to do the same thing, don't we? We have to point out a foot. Cut it off. There it is. But it's not a nose and it's not an eye. We have to get a nose that is not a foot, and is not an eye. So now we have to point out, don't we, obviously, an eye, a self, that's distinct. That is not the nose, and is not the foot, and indeed is not the eyelashes, the pee-pee, the caca, the muscles, the joints, or the other billion parts. We believe 1,000,000,000% that there is one in there somewhere. We're utterly convinced. It's totally assumed as a truth. Every word we say reinforces this. Everything we do reinforces this. We utterly believe it, but without any proof ever whatsoever. And Buddha says we have to disprove this lie. And it's the hardest job we'll ever do. Even as we hear it, we're puzzled. Buddha says, you won't find that one. You won't find, this is even the grosser level, it's not the subtlest one yet. In other words, you won't find a piece called I among the other pieces. It's like we're convinced there's a piece called I walking hand in hand, as my friend Penday says, with the other pieces. That's how we think. Don't analyze it, we think. Buddha says, you won't find such one. And he says, it doesn't take too long. There's only so many pieces in there. We can't hear this. It seems almost stupid. Of course there's an eye, we'll say. So another tack, another way to look at it. What's the name of this action I'm just doing? Thank you. Rabina's holding a cup. It's a statement of truth, isn't it? So let's analyze it, shall we? Let's start looking for the component parts that play a role in the action called Rabina is holding a cup. Can you hear me? Let's analyze the component parts. Like as if, you know, what's, you know, you got to tell, you got to write down on a piece of paper, because I've forgotten everything. I've forgotten how to pick up cups. So you've got to write down all the instructions for me. You'd have probably 1,000 things that I'd have to do, wouldn't you? You'd say, well, first you've got to analyse, what is it? The right hand, oh, okay. And what part of the hand? Well, the fingers. And what part of the fingers? Well, the thumbs. And what part of the fingers? And the ligaments, and the this, and the joints, and the thing, and the that, and the muscles. There'd be a million little pieces all working hand in hand to make the action of holding the cup. Would you agree with that? Each, so okay, the arm is the first one. The muscles here have to work. Then we go down to the forearm. Then we go down to the wrist. Then we go down to the left, the right hand here, the thumb here, and this here, and the middle finger, and then the index, the ring finger. The little pinky's not doing much. They can manage to be out of it. But the rest, then all the palm, all the muscles, all the joints, all the ligaments. You'd write thousands of things down, wouldn't you? And I'd have to follow every one of those instructions to get to do the lift up the cup, isn't it? It's like making a building. You've got to learn to know how to do it. Wouldn't you do that? Well, so far we've mentioned millions. We could have mentioned millions of things here. You agree? We mentioned thumb, ligaments, muscles. My arms are getting sore already. My upper arms, my middle arms, my thing. We've mentioned all those things, right? Now we can see the crucial piece that's playing the role is the mind, isn't it? The mind is the main one. If this were a dead body, it wouldn't hold a cup, would it? So the mind plays a role, doesn't it? A major role. Would you agree with that? So now we have to start looking at what parts of the mind are playing their role in the action. Rabina is holding a cup, okay? So we start to look and using the Buddha's view. You've got many parts of the mind. The very first one is the intention. I will hold the cup. Without that, believe me, it won't happen. So intention plays a role, crucial. Then I've got to pay attention, another one called attention. Then I've got to have recognition that distinguishes the cup from the thermos. Then I've got to have mindfulness, which means I can't forget that I'm holding the cup, otherwise I'll drop it. Then I've got to have recognition and this and that and intelligence. Many, many, many pieces of your mind, all different concepts, all working spontaneously. Are you with me, people? Can you hear this? So there are thousands of bits and pieces of Robina working to have the action. Robina is holding a cup. Do you agree with this? Now, can you notice that so far we haven't identified a piece called I? Can you hear that? Can you hear that? Well, what do you want a bloody eye for, Buddha says? It's an unnecessary embellishment. You don't need an eye. The parts work very nicely together. It's a good way to put it. Can you hear me here? But we're shocked by this. No, there's got to be an eye running the show, we say. Well, that's God. That's a creator. You don't need one. The parts work beautifully together. Can you sort of hear it? It's a bit shocking to us because we believe there's a little eye in there running the show. We assume there is, you know. Coming. We put up this story, we've got this picture of Rabina, this little bubble here of attachment, and a little one over here of arrogance, a little one over here of fat and small and Buddhist nun, all the story we build up around this little eye we think is in there, which isn't. Which doesn't mean there's no Rabina. What does it mean finally? They say when you've proven this one, you come to the conclusion that Rabina is a name given to this valid base. So it's like smoke and mirrors. Conventionally, there is a Rabina that does exist that is merely labeled. But as soon as you start to search, you can't find. Which ultimately means there's no Rabina from her own side. But that doesn't mean there's no Rabina. It's smoke and mirrors. It's like illusion, like illusion, like illusion. And it's the way to talk how to manage this. But the thing is, in all, even the different Buddhist schools, forget about the Hindu view where Buddha diverged, several Buddhist schools before this view we're describing here, which is the Prasangika Majjhimika view, which is the view that all our lamas teach, there are other views in the Buddhist schools that all would say, that, well, you've got to find something there. You've got to have something. It's like we're scaredy baby and it's too scared to fall off the cliff. So you have to hold on to something. And each of those schools, it's all something in the mind, they say, which is the commonest one we think. It must be in the mind. There's got to be an eye in there in the mind. You know, there has to be somewhere. Don't need, Buddha says. Don't need. The parts do fine on their own. It's a way to put it, you know. Sorry, you have some question? That's right. That's right. That's right. Yeah, everything is okay, put it this way. You see, so we're just saying there's no I. And then we go, oh, but Rabina, you just said there's a boss. Well, also, there's no boss. So you start to look in boss, the parts of a boss, for the boss, and you won't find an inherent boss. So conventionally, there's a boss, but ultimately not. So it's this tricky thing of seeing that when you say boss, or pee-pee, or kaka, or heaven, or hell, or enlightenment, or eye, or body, or breast, or nipple, or toenail. As soon as we say it, oh, there must be something. No, it's just a name too. Fits parts. So everything you say is a name imputed by the mind on its appropriate parts. So within this, you can have ordinary language. You can just kind of play act. Oh, I had a good time today. Did you, darling? I'm so happy. You know. Or you can, you know, I did this, I did that. So if you're going to talk to yourself, you say, well, the person known as Rabina had a good time. But you'd be stupid if you said that to other people. They'd get annoyed with you. You know, just be normal, Rabina, pretend. But you're play acting, but not buying into the inherent Rabina. And that's the part that's tricky. Of course, it's highly realized to get this. Yeah. Is that a hand? No. Any questions then? Come on. Any questions? Yes. Can't hear. Where's the microphone, please? Pass back.
I don't know if I've got a bit confused, but does ego need attachment and aversion
ego
to it?
Ego is another word for I. For I.
So does
self,
it
person, I.
Yeah. So does it need attachment and aversion to validate itself?
That's right. Exactly. Another way of saying it. But attachment and aversion and all the other delusions, I put it this way, are the voices of the neurotic I, yeah. Yeah, that kind of they play out the role of the neurotic eye. Once you've realised there's no eye, attachment and aversion collapse because there's nothing to be attached to or aversion for. That's right. You could say that. You could say that, yes.
So by not following your attachments and aversion...
What, darling?
So by not following...
Attachment.
...and aversion... Like,
yes.
...like lessening that...
That's right.
...you lessen the
Absolutely,
eye.
Girl. Yeah. That's what practice is. Absolutely. That's why that's junior school. Then getting the emptiness one is sort of like university. You know, or actually working on the delusions and working on your body and speech is like junior school. Working on your mind and attachment and lessening them is like high school. And then you realise emptiness is taught in the context of the six perfections on the bodhisattva path. That's when you get university level. You combine it with bodhicitta. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And all the teachings and the way it's taught in the monasteries, everything is structured, like any course. It's structured to lead you to the most advanced stuff. So all the course, everything is structured to lead you to this one. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes, sweetheart.
If there's no I and
inherent I,
inherent
independent
I, or no boss,
Serena, yeah.
Then is there a mind?
Is there what?
A mind.
Well, we have the same discussion. Mind. You start to look, so let's look into them. Whatever you posit, mind or a peanut. So what's a mind? Well, mind is the name we give to its parts. So why don't you search within the parts of the mind for the inherent mind? Is there a peanut? Well, peanut's the name we give to its component parts. So we search within the component parts of a peanut to search for the independent peanut. Is there a nose? Will you start to search within the parts of a nose for the inherent nose? Is there an ear? Will you start to search among the parts, looking for an inherent ear among the parts? You do it for the same as any phenomenon you posit. Serena. Okay, darling.
Sorry, I've got a question, too.
Okay.
So my question is like...
A bit louder, darling.
The eye. Does the eye exist like temporarily? I mean, my question is like...
Which eye? The neurotic one or which one?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, says something that reacts to attachment or anger or
fear. I don't understand you. Please start again. Get more clear.
Okay. So when we say like emptiness is form and form is emptiness, does it mean that like... The form is empty of what we add to it,
no,
but it exists temporarily.
Shh. Nothing to do with it. You're running off into a la la land. Shush. Ask another question, simple one. What's your actual question? What's your actual question? Do you know what's your actual question?
I forgot. Forgot it.
I don't blame you, darling. So when you think about it, you ask me. Who else? Yes. Give the mic, please. Give her the mic. I couldn't hear you. What, sweetheart?
How did he get out of the river?
I have no idea, but obviously he did. He didn't tell that part of the story.
Oh.
Maybe he's mad. I don't know. No idea. Any more questions? Down here, question. Go on. Try, darling.
Okay. Given that... With reference to negative action,
Negative actions. Okay.
Negative action. Mm-hmm. Okay. When I do the confession prayer, the visualization. Uh-huh. So there is no I that create the negative action. There is not the creator of negative okay. action. Good. In yeah. emptiness, there is no creating That's of right. negative action.
That's right.
So where I stumble question? Is.
What's with her?
Where I stumble uh-huh. is. Yeah, but then negative action create an effect on your life. Like, it's got consequences.
Okay, darling,
so
what
are we looking at?
What's the question? Try and say it as a question. What's the one question from this? What's your confusion?
The confusion is that a negative action cannot be empty as it has consequences.
So you're saying, okay, good. So you're saying, okay, that's fine. Let's go through this. So you're suggesting that Buddha's mistaken in thinking that everything that exists is empty of inherent existence. So first step. So would you agree that conventionally speaking, there is a phenomenon you can point to called the action of killing? Can you point to that? Can you point to an action called the action of killing?
Yeah.
Okay, so that does exist. It's a phenomenon.
It does.
So Buddha says whatever exists is empty of inherent existence. So you disagree. You think it does exist inherently. Why is that? Why? What would be your reason?
Sorry, I don't understand.
You just said it has to exist inherently. You just said that. You don't accept
No, no, no.
Okay, what's your question? Sweetheart. It's okay, you're saying it well. What's
convention.
Your question?
I'm not at that level. I can't follow you. That's well, okay, why in a simple way. Can you talk to me like a 2-year-old? Like, I don't understand why a negative action...
Okay, please then. Yeah. Ask me your question. And I'll see if I can answer it. Just ask the one question. Okay. What's the question? Don't give a statement. What's your question? And then I'll see if I can okay. answer it, darling.
How can in emptiness not be a negative action when a negative action yeah. causes okay. karmic consequences?
So what you're suggesting is that a negative action isn't empty. That's what you're suggesting. You said, how come, your question is, how come a negative action is empty? Is that your question? How come a negative action can be empty?
Yes.
That's your question?
Yes.
That's your question?
Yes.
So you're suggesting it isn't empty, aren't you, therefore? Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
It seems confusing to you that a negative action is empty. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Since it has consequences.
Okay, so what do you think it means, empty? That's the next step to ask yourself so you can get clear. That's the question to ask yourself. What do you think it means a negative action is empty? What do you think it means? If you think it isn't empty, you have to have a sense of what you think it does mean. So what do you think it does mean? Why does it conflict for you when you hear that a negative action is empty? Okay, I'll put words into your mouth. You're suggesting that when Lama Zopa says to think about how there is no negative action, you're thinking that he's saying there is no negative action at all. Are you accepting? That's what you think, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
well,
okay.
you're wrong, yeah. aren't you? You
so
know that. You just chucked the baby out with the bath water, darling. You just thought of it as nihilism. You,
okay.
When you hear that within emptiness there is no negative action, you're thinking that Lama Zopa is saying, it's all right, darling, there is no negative action. That's what you're thinking, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you accept? Right, so what you've done is what we all do, is make the mistake of thinking that when you hear that negative karma is empty, that I is empty, that kaka is empty, that whatever exists is empty, when you're making the mistake of when you hear that, of thinking that Buddha says, there is no kaka at all, there is no I at all.
Mm-hmm.
That's called nihilism. Nice. You just mm-hmm. threw out too much. Can you hear that?
Yes.
So therefore, the thinking is that you have to do, which we all have to do, is to hear how, when Lama Zopa says, like Buddha, within emptiness there is no negative karma, you've got to get the meaning of that, don't you, properly. Because he's clearly not saying there is no action. He's not saying that. It's more nuanced than that. This has been our discussion this morning, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So whether you say negative karma or whether you say I, it's the same discussion.
Same.
Are okay. we communicating?
All right, yeah, I understand. Yeah, thank you. No, because I was doing the practice of the confession.
I understand you're doing
downfall
that.
Downfall confession. But when it comes
Sweetheart,
to,
shush, you don't
to
need
emptiness,
to say more.
I
you don't
can
need to say
visualize
more.
It.
You don't need
stuck.
To say more.
All right, I won't.
So listen carefully, and now we will do the discussion for you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. You're just like all of us, darling. We all do exactly that because we can't hear it properly. Do you understand, darling? So the key to this is just to get your head around the presentation of the two truths. So let's establish, like we established a cup, okay? We've established an eye. We've talked about a cup and an eye. Now let's talk about another phenomenon that does exist called a negative action. Are we communicating here? So like any of these things that we posit, are you listening? You're chatting to your friend. Oh, shut up. You're just wanting approval, clever boy. Just listen. It's exhausting for me to talk. Can't you hear? Poor little me. Where's my cough drop? I've lost my cough drops. Okay. Buddha says, whatever exists in the universe, period. So hear the words. Whatever does exist. Hear the words. Affirmative statement. Whatever does exist in the universe necessarily lacks inherent existence. No, you don't. So be quiet. Let's just be quiet. Therefore, whatever does exist is empty of existing inherently. Therefore, within emptiness, there is no I. There is no cup. There is no negative karma. So that's what we have to learn to understand, isn't it? So let's see if we can unpack that, to see if we can understand that statement. Yeah? Okay. So we established a cup before, didn't we? You name it, you define it, you prove it is that, and then you all sign off and we all agree it's a cup. So let's now, we did this yesterday briefly, but now in this context, let's establish a phenomenon that does exist called a negative action. Just like eye or cup, same status. So let's establish that. What is it? Well, according to Buddha, the definition of a negative action would be one that harms another. Not what Buddha says you shouldn't do, which is what the Christian teaching is. A negative action for Christians is what God says you shouldn't do, which is the philosophy we have now. Mummy says I shouldn't do it. Daddy says I shouldn't do it. They say I shouldn't do it. The police say I shouldn't do it. The judge says I shouldn't do it, which is why we live in fear of worrying about what other people think of us, because we're trying to be good girls and boys, which is our main attachment, which we'll talk about later, which is a meaningless concept. So let's analyze, let's break into its component parts. Okay, we just also discussed before, didn't we, the action called, the phenomenon called Rabina is holding a cup. We did that, didn't we? And we did a bit of analysis, quickly trying to see what are the component parts of that action. We did that, didn't we? So just like we did the component parts of a cup, a clay, the base, a handle. It's not too complicated, is it? The component parts of a person, you can narrow it down to two, body and mind. You with me, people? So we've got to establish the component parts first, because it's within those component parts that we have to search for the inherent thing that we just posited. So here, we're looking for the I among the component parts. Here, we're looking for the cup, the inherent cup among the component parts. Here, we're looking for the inherent Rabina is holding a cup in the action of Rabina is holding a cup. Are we communicating? So now let's look at how we're going to look at a phenomenon called a negative action. So we have to search among the component parts of the negative action to look for the inherent negative action, which is what she just stated. That's how we think about negativity. Well, it has to be wrong. It's wrong from its own side. It's wrong somehow because it's just wrong. That's how we think of negativity. It's inherently wrong. That's why we have so much guilt. But it too is a dependent arising. Dependent arising, as Lama Yeshe puts it, is the king of logics to prove emptiness. So the thinking we have to do to trigger the insight into emptiness is about dependent arising. So let's look into the dependent arisings of the phenomenon called killing a mouse. Just like we look for the inherent Rabina among the parts of Rabina. We look for the action called negative action of killing a mouse among the component parts. Everything that exists is made of parts. So it's among the parts that you have to search for the one that you think is in there somewhere running the show. We don't think like that, but that's how we think. We don't think we think like that. So let's analyze the action called killing a mouse, the dependent arising thing called a negative action. Okay, we did it yesterday. It's got four main, a complete action of killing has four main components. The first part has to be, and obviously a negative action doesn't exist in the sky, does it? A person does a negative action, don't they? A person is a mind possessor, aren't they? So a mind actually does a negative action, doesn't it? Your foot's involved if you stand on the mouse, isn't it? But this is why the power of the word intention, which is meaning karma, this is what creates everything. The thought begins the whole show. Do you understand? So the component parts of the action called killing the mouse by the person called Rabina, let's say, because the person has to do it, can't just be in the sky. It's not abstract, it's real. So we first established it. So there's a mouse. So the first thing is there has to be a mouse there in front of Rabina, not over there in Africa. In front of Rabina in her kitchen, there's a mouse. First point, object. Second point is called generally intention, and it's divided into 2A, 2B, and 2C. So the next piece, the 2A, is that has to be the state of mind called recognition, which is happening every millisecond, that is the ability to distinguish between this and that. So I have to recognize it's that mouse that I'm going to kill. That's the next component. In being one of the components in this phenomenon called the action of killing a mouse, or the negative action of killing the mouse. The next component is 2B. It's the actual thought, the intention. I will kill the mouse. There's the next component, 2C, the motivation for killing the mouse. Anger. Which is negative, which is how dare that mouse be in my kitchen. It's completely negative, it's outrageous, it's phenomenal, it's completely self-centered, monstrous state of mind. Arrogant, self-centered, brutal, anger pervades the mind. That compels the intention, that causes me to pick up my hand, you know, and do whatever I do to kill the mouse. So the third part is action. My hand does the job with my mind focused, with recognition, with intention, with motivation, anger running the whole thing. Anger drives it. With mindfulness, with attention, all these things are playing a perfect role together to make sure the action is done. And then fourth, rejoicing. Great, the mouse is dead. They are the component parts. They are the basis of the label, a negative action of killing. Are we communicating here? Okay. So then what Buddha's saying is, like a cup, like Rabina, like a self, like anything that does exist, like the action of holding a cup, like anything that does exist, that action, that thing, that phenomenon, that thought, that idea, that toenail, whatever it is, doesn't exist as that from its own side, in and of itself, out there having, this is the subtlest one, having nothing to do with the mind calling it that. That's the ultimate dependent arising. The subtlest. How you search for it is you've got to start looking among those parts for the I, among the parts for the inherent cup, and indeed among the parts of the negative action of killing a mouse, the components we just stated. You've got to search among those for the piece that is the inherent negative action that makes it negative inherently. You won't find it. So it too is a dependent arising. Therefore, it too doesn't exist in and of itself as a negative action, which doesn't mean it's not a negative action. It is, conventionally. The mouse gets hurt. Rabina, because of her anger, creates negative karma. It will sow seeds in her mind that will ripen in the future as her suffering. All of this occurs. And in fact, Buddha says, if it weren't empty of existing from its own side, if it were existing inherently as a bad action, if Rabina did exist inherently, if the cup did exist inherently, it would be frozen in space. It would have no parts, it would have no causes, it couldn't move. In fact, the Buddha says nothing could exist. In fact, one of the statements the Buddha makes is things exist because they are empty of existing inherently. So, as we talked yesterday, the key component in this action of killing a mouse that makes it a negative action when I do it isn't the object called mouse, isn't I will kill the mouse, isn't the foot, the hand doing it, isn't even the result. They're all there, they're crucial, but the piece that is the main player, the one brick in this edifice called the negative action of killing a mouse, because it's made of many bricks, isn't it? Can you hear the analogy? It's made of many pieces. The one brick that is the crucial central one that gives it the character of being a negative action for Rabina when she does it, which means sowing seeds in her mind that will produce future suffering for Rabina's mind. The one brick, the key one, is the anger piece. 2B. You with me, people? 2C. That one priest. Now, this is the point. If you take the Mahayana view, you pull out that one brick, and Natasha, her action of killing a mouse, everything else is exactly the same, except that one brick. Her brick in there, her motivation, like we talked yesterday, is compassion. Are you hearing me, people? Are you hearing me? Compassion. So everything is different because of that one brick. There's the object, there's the recognition, there's the intention, the motivation is the wish to help the mouse. There's the action and the result. Great, it's dead. But look how that one piece totally changes the character of the entire action for Natasha. Can you hear that? That proves that killing a mouse is not inherently negative. It's negative if all those pieces are in place. But those pieces being there, including anger, are all the pieces that cause it to be a negative action. Take one piece out, you change it. If you take the white paint off the building and make it red paint, it changes it, doesn't it? So one piece is different, the whole dynamic is different. This is dependent arising in terms of parts. That's why it's so subtle and nuanced. You can't just say negative action from its own side, you're bad. That's how we talk. I'm bad. It's completely concrete, paralysis, bizarre, demented conclusion to come to. It's extreme, it's embellishing, it's exaggerating, it's concretizing, it's paralysis, it's based on believing an inherent bad me. You hearing me? That's why many people, we talk about purification. How can it change? I'm still bad. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's how we think, because we're so concrete. That's what ego grasping does. I'm a bad person. We hold it in space, stuck, paralyzed, concrete, absolute, no dependent arising at all. That's why we think we can never change. We cling grimly to this pathetic, low self-esteem, ugly view of poor me. And no matter what we do, it doesn't seem to change. We paint ourselves pink and blue and get thin and thick and long nails, short nails, bald hair. I'm still pathetic. You're kind of hearing me. You put one brick out, the anger, you put in compassion. I'm not recommending you kill with compassion. I'm pointing out dependent arising here. Can you hear me? The implication of dependent arising is therefore there's nothing from its own side, therefore it's empty, which doesn't mean nothing. It means, wow, it's dependent arising. So the key way to think with Lama Tsongkhapa's presentation of the two truths, every time we think empty, you know, there is no I from its own side, the instinct, because of ego grasping, is to throw the baby out with the bathwater and go, oh, there's no me. I might as well kill myself. Isn't it? And then every time we hear dependent arising, Rabina, there is an I that does exist in dependence upon many causes, many parts, and blah, blah, blah. Naturally, the instinct is, oh, thank God there is a me after all. Grasp. Is it not? And we go between these two like drunken sailors, you know, either clinging to this view, which is the eternalistic view, which is the view in day-to-day life of attachment getting what it wants. Everything's hunky-dory, perfect now, I found happiness, perfect, divine, wow, we'd be, you know, like Paul and Nicole Kidman, I always quote her, I like the girl, but in one of her interviews with Vanity Fair years ago when she was still with Tom Cruise, and she said at the end of the article, we will be together until we're 80. You recognize what I'm saying? That's attachment talking. That's the eternalistic view. You've found happiness, it's perfect, divine, all gorgeous and perfect, delicious. It's a fantasy. It's not recognizing truth of impermanence and all these things, not to mention no inherent existence. And then, of course, when the bubble bursts, what happens? You go crashing down to despair, don't we? The despair of nihilism, which is the energy behind, you know, depression and killing yourself. We run between these two like mad people, you know. The two extreme views. They're both lies in the mind. So the practice is, every time we hear emptiness, you get yourself from falling over the abyss. And you say to yourself, ha ha, Rabina, it's being empty. Rabina being empty means Rabina's a dependent arising. And every time you think, oh, there's a Rabina and cling, no, no, Rabina. Dependent arising Rabina means there is no Rabina from her own side. So these two come beautifully together eventually in the middle way, where these eventually are simultaneous. So even intellectually, if we can practice thinking dependent arising means emptiness, and emptiness means dependent arising, we are really on track, as Nagarjuna says. We're really on track in Buddha's view. We bring these two truths together, not rush off into the two extremes. Then we begin to, you know, understand it. We have to practice that. Because instinctively, every one of us says what she said. Every question we ask, Serena's question, it implies no I. Period, no I, no negative karma. As she says, how could it be empty? She means, how could there be no negative karma? She's hearing it too extreme. She's throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Can you hear that? We do that instinctively, naturally. So we're going to catch it, grab it, and bring it to the dependent arising. Every time you cling too strongly, you put it to emptiness, and you bring these two together. It's a marvelous technique. Intellectually, in your head, slowly it becomes tasty. And we start to get meaning. Are we communicating? The point is here, too, in terms of purification, it's very relevant. The four opponent powers that we talked about yesterday, which are powerful components, they're the dependent arising components of the action called purifying negative karma. They don't pull out completely all the seeds. It's only when you've finally realized emptiness that you cut the root of all delusions. Only then. But it leads you to it. So when we realize emptiness, that's when we've finally purified. Well, you've got more to go. So up until now, Buddha says we've had countless lives. We've been kings and queens and universal monarchs, and we've been rich and poor, been in the hell realms and the heaven realms and God knows what. We've been happy, sad, rich, poor, suffering, human, dog, animal, whale, you name it. But we've never realized emptiness. That's the one we have to do. That's the one that cuts. This cuts. This gets to the root of all delusions, the root of all suffering. When that's been cut, in fact, from the first second, of your non-conceptual direct perception, insight into emptiness of the inherent I, from that second, you can no longer fall back. You can only go forward. From that second, this paradigm shift has been made. Yeah. Give the microphone, please.
So you said that the teaching on emptiness was like high school, and that what was like high school, and obviously there were steps before that.
Okay, no. Okay, can I explain that a bit just before you ask the question?
Sure.
Let me just explain a bit more clearly this point. Okay. In the Lam Rim, this presentation, which is the Gelugpa packaging of the teachings, but it's the same as all the lamas and all the Tibetan teachings. They've got variations on this packaging, right, of all Buddhist teachings. So junior school level, or as they call it in Tibetan, the lowest scope of practice, it's all about controlling your body and your speech and beginning to control your mind, to stop killing, stop lying, stop stealing, live in vows and do purification. That's junior school practice. And this will guarantee you, you'll have a blissful life and then you die, you'll get a really good human rebirth. No problems. But you're not really becoming your own therapist yet. That's high school. So in high school, now you've subdued your body and speech, you can now learn to concentrate, meditate, you learn the Buddhist model of the mind, you start learning about the delusions, and then you start being your own therapist, unpacking and unraveling the delusions, like attachment and anger especially, these ones. That's high school. You with me? Now, if you were going to graduate there as a Theravadan practitioner, do you understand that? You would also realize emptiness. And then you say, bye-bye, I'm leaving. You zap off to your nirvana. But if you're practicing the Mahayana path, emptiness is taught at the end of the Bodhisattva path as the sixth of the six perfections of a Bodhisattva. And it's combined, the unique characteristic of the understanding of emptiness in the Bodhisattva path, it's taught in conjunction with bodhicitta. So the six perfections of the Bodhisattva, which is university, generosity, morality, patience, enthusiasm, and then the last two are the two types of meditation, concentration and insight into emptiness. Do you understand? Okay, then, question?
So you're saying basically some...
In the microphone, darling.
Okay, the monastic, some monastic traditions in Asia would have that very clearly laid out in terms of structure.
You not to do with the monastic, not monastic. That's not relevant here.
You use the word structure and monastic.
I didn't say monastic.
Okay, all right.
I didn't say monastic. What do you think I said? When did I say that? What?
About half an
hour. The structure of the path, darling. The structure of the entire path to enlightenment.
Okay.
What?
But then how do you get that right? I mean, living in the Western world, living in a big city, how do you even start to go to kindergarten and then go to the next step and then get it in a structured way? How is it? Is it available? Where is it? How is it available?
Mother of Jesus, God in heaven, where have you been living all these years? Have you been practicing Buddhism?
Sorry?
You're a practitioner of Buddhism, right? A little bit?
Kind of.
How long?
But less than 2 years.
Well, thank you, but you've been going to Tibetan Buddhist classes?
A bit, but on and off.
Okay,
because I travel.
Well, that's what you've been here. I mean, are you a lay person?
Yeah.
What is this room full of?
Laypersons.
Thank you. What am I talking here?
Sorry?
This exact structure. I'm not talking to monks and nuns in this room. I'm talking to you. If it's not relevant to you, why are you here? Get your money back, please.
Okay.
Are we communicating, darling, or not?
No, we are, but it seems to me that you've taught us something which is high school, and I don't even get the basic rights.
Well, then one step at a time. I'm trying to give you everything I can this weekend. I'm trying to be generous and give you as much as possible,
all
and
right.
Then you plug into where you belong. You started junior school.
All
where
right.
else would you start, darling?
Okay, all right.
You'd
Makes
be bored
sense.
If I just spent the entire weekend talking about how not to lie and kill. You'll be groaning and going to sleep. I've got to make you excited.
We are excited.
Thank you. That makes sense.
Then you can
sense.
Hear it and go, oh, I'd like to do that. Sort of like, you know, it's tasty and exciting. Emptiness, bodhicitta. I haven't talked about bodhicitta yet. That's a killer, I tell you. Emptiness is nothing in comparison to bodhicitta. Bodhicitta scares the life out of me.
I get it.
Are we communicating?
We are.
Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Come on. Another 25 minutes yet before lunch. I need a cough drop. Who's got a cough drop? Oh, is that a cough drop? No, that's just a mint. Yeah, she's got them, look. That just is hot peppermint. It's not the same. This has kind of got a drug in it. It's nice. Any more questions? I'm trying to be like Ronnie Corbett. I know it doesn't work, but... Any more questions? Please, really, serious. Any more questions? Are you a bit clearer or not? It's hard, though. It is hard. I do agree it is hard, you know. It really is. The stuff is just hard, but don't think it's not possible.
Hi. Sorry. Can I ask something?
Where are you? Okay, go on.
Hiya. It's about karma.
Yeah.
People go and free fish. I don't want to be judgmental, but
well,
when they free them...
Don't talk about people. Don't talk about people. Just ask a question. I want a long
okay.
lecture
when
you, from
when
you.
When you free fish... And
sorry, what?
When you're free in at a freeing ceremony for fish, I know that some of the fish die, but their intention
sorry, I'm just
is
a minute
right.
Wait, girl. Your question's so riddled with assumptions, I can't get there. Can you keep it a really simple, objective question?
If you're believing that
question,
you're doing the right thing...
Okay, so you're doing an action...
Are you
and
getting the
oh,
good
wait a minute,
karma?
Stop right there. So you're talking about doing an action with a pure motivation. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And the particular action is called saving the life of an animal. Is that correct? Excuse me, a fish is an animal.
Yeah, they're saving it and blessing it at the same time.
What?
They're saving and blessing.
Forget, just a minute. Wait a minute. So your question is, Rabina, does the action of saving the life of an animal with a pure motivation, including saying a mantra in its ear, so that's the first step. Now, what's the question in relation to that? What's the question in relation to that?
Do you get bad karma from having good intention?
God Almighty,
knowing
what do you think
when
I've been
dies?
Talking about all this time? This, shows, this is my
well,
point.
Well, I believe
this is
that
my
it's
point.
Not a good
it's
idea.
It's so hard to hear this stuff.
Slightly confusing.
No, darling, it's
what
crystal
what I believe is
clear.
Different from
Did
what
you
other
hear?
People
What's
believe.
What's your name?
Penny.
Thank you, darling. Listen to me, Penny. Forgive me my terrible rudeness. Did you hear the story yesterday? Did you hear the story
no,
today?
No, I wasn't here yesterday,
Did you hear the story today about the action of killing a mouse?
Yes, I did.
I went into quite a lot of detail, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Did you hear me talk about the brick called anger in my case?
Yes.
Which is the motivation to harm the mouse, isn't it?
Yes, I understand.
And then did
that.
I discuss the one called the brick called compassion in Natasha's case?
Yeah.
Did you
so
hear that?
My
which
friends
is your,
are swapping
which
the
is
brick.
Your question.
Okay.
So the question is, did Natasha create negative karma or positive karma? Is that your question? Is that your question?
No,
Penny.
It's...
What's your question?
Well, if you're swapping that brick to compassion.
No, that's my view. We're just talking about Natasha killing a mouse with a pure intention.
Yeah.
That's
so,
all your
so,
a pure motivation.
Yeah,
so that's
that,
your question.
That is part
so your
of the question,
question is,
yeah.
Penny, did Natasha create good karma
yeah.
or negative karma? Is that your question?
Yeah.
Penny? Is that your question?
That is part of my question.
What's the rest of it, dear?
Well, if the answer is the...
Well, let's do the answer first.
If the answer
let's
is
Let's do the
yes.
answer first, Penny.
Go on then, do the answer.
Thank you. The point here is, from the Mahayana point of view, the one piece in an action, like the example of me and her, that makes the massive difference in terms of the person doing it, not for the mouse, not for the fish. They've got their karma, they're going to die, and they're going to go to the hells or wherever they go. That's a different discussion. We're talking about how we each create karma. Mm-hmm. And the crucial piece here, we went into detail yesterday, is that the motivation for why you do something, the motivation for why you do it, even if you harm a creature and it goes to the lower realms, like in the case of her mouse, let's say, or your fish, she meant well. That already dynamically changes the character of the karma she creates because motivation is the key. Mine clearly is negative because I wanted to harm the mouse. So that's what makes it negative for me. She wanted to help the mouse. That's what makes it, you'd say, some virtuous karma there because she meant well. Even though it's not enough, you've got to have wisdom as well. So that's the answer to your question. So what's the next question as a result of that?
There's lots of delusional people that commit
crimes. No, this
crimes.
Is just your personal discussion. You have to extrapolate all your own answers from what I've just said. You just got all your political opinions here. That's fine, darling. You're allowed to have them. But ask a question from this, not just make a statement. Ask a question. It helps for clarity.
If I was delusional and killed that mouse...
So just a minute. Stop right there. Stop, Penny, please. What do you mean delusional?
Like...
What, no,
you're,
Penny,
you're confusing me.
No,
by
I'm trying to help you be clear, even though
so
it's a bit aggressive. You've got all these emotional statements in there. You don't know it. Forgive me, being arrogant. But, so, what do you mean by delusional?
Well, for instance, can I give you an example? If someone went to kill someone and they really believed at that point, for some reason, that it was the right thing to do.
It's the same as the mouse. There's no difference.
Yeah,
you just said
same
that.
Thing
so
for
what's
the
your
mouse.
Question? What's your
they
question?
End up in prison for 20 years. Mm-hmm. They're hated.
So what's your question, darling? What's your question?
Are they getting good karma from that? Do you believe?
That's not relevant. Nothing to do with anything. That's meaningless. You just, it's all this extra thought you've got. That's not the discussion here.
No,
that's
but some, it's not meaningless.
It is.
Because they,
not, Penny,
they felt
Penny.
That it was the right thing to do.
She's a stubborn girl, this Penny. She's determined. Listen, Penny. We've just answered your first question.
Yeah.
You have to think about that. And if you read the book I've given you, there's all the teachings in there about
okay.
this. You've got to really give it some thought. You've mm-hmm. got to really give it some thought. As for the consequences of all that, if you go kill a person you meant well, of course it's a big drag having to go to prison. That's another discussion, darling. Or something else. So the key question is, so but you began with a fish, you know. So if I let you go on with your story, I would have heard it, but I kind of can hear it already. So you've got to think about this, Petal. I've given you all the information. It's all in there for you to really think it through. The key question is, does she create negative karma or positive? Mm. And you say delusional. You say it very easily. You know, we're all delusional, darling. Until you got clairvoyance, you're delusional.
I'm just wondering if we don't, if there's no, if we're not that person, you're talking about the inner person. Who's the one who judges us? There's no God. Who's the one who puts us in the category of good karma and bad karma?
Yourself. Not even yourself, your actions. Who decides that you get burned when fire burns you? Who decides? What's the answer? Who decides? What's the answer? Nobody. Why? Because it's a natural law, isn't it? You don't need to know that fire burns you. It's a natural law that fingers meet fire, it'll hurt, won't it? Would you agree with that?
Yes.
No one has to say it's going to burn you. It's not punishment, is it? It's not reward. It's not a political position, is it? It's a natural law. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Same with karma, darling. Negativity brings suffering. Virtue brings happiness, Buddha says. It's a natural law, sweetheart.
So it's your own karma.
It's a natural law that what you do and what you think will leave imprints in your mind that will ripen in the future as experiences and tendencies similar to that. So Buddha's basically saying that what we do think and say literally creates us from moment to moment and life to life. There's no one up there running the show.
Okay, thank you.
Do you understand?
Yeah, I do.
That was a very
understand.
Good question, that part was excellent.
Thank you.
Yes, pass the mic.
Thank you. Yes, how does... karma, how does it work with, if you have an animal, a pet, and the animal's got fleas, ticks, you know, parasites living
That's
on
right.
it.
That's right.
And the vet says you have to use
That's right. Yes,
the
so
stuff.
Then question.
Well, what do you do? Do you put the stuff on the animal and kill the fleas?
Well,
or
based on what you've heard, give it an analysis here. Is a flea a sentient being?
Yes.
Okay, so I've got a mind. Was your mother in a past life?
Yes.
Okay. So you've got sentient being eating another sentient being,
yeah.
haven't you?
Yeah.
So it's a dilemma for you, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so what do you think?
Well, I refrain.
How would you try and deal with it?
I have refrained. I'm talking about my dog, and I have refrained from putting anything on my dog for
Good
about
darling.
A year.
Why would you do that? Because why?
Because I don't want to create the karma from killing the fleas.
That's very intelligent. That's what Buddha would suggest you do. What's the problem then?
Well, my dog is suffering.
Why can't you pull the bloody fleas out and put them somewhere else?
They just keep...
Excuse
you
me,
know,
why can't you make the effort to really make the effort? A friend of... Listen, stop. Listen. A friend of mine, she was off in a meditation retreat for many years, and she was in America, and she had millions of moths.
Okay.
She spent weeks... Each moth.
Oh.
And released it. Blue mantra and released it. Weeks.
Okay.
That takes work, darling.
It does.
But the first step has to be you've got to decide, which you've done, I don't want to kill. Why? Because you're trying to be a good person, because you don't want to create negative karma. And incidentally, you don't want to harm the flea. That's the basis of all Buddhist practice. It's incredible. Of course, life is full of dilemmas. It's quite difficult. And we all know, though. Let's say these fleas were your pets.
Okay.
Everything would change, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You'd go to the ends of the earth to save your precious fleas. It's only because you have more attachment, most people have more attachment for a dog than a flea, that we kill the flea. But if you have this attachment to your fleas, you'd spend so much money to find methods that the scientists, the medical world, the scientific world would spend billions on finding wonderful ways to save fleas because they're our new set of pets.
Okay.
So we can do it if we try. So you've got to be persevering and find ways to remove the fleas. Do your best. We've got to do our best, darling.
Okay.
The point is, Buddha would say, there's not an atom of space you won't find sentient beings. Every millisecond, every millimeter of all the elements, all the things here, are pervaded by minds. So just by breathing, you are killing. By living, you are killing. By walking, you are killing. This is the nightmare of samsara. So the very best we can do is, if we meet living beings, try our best not to harm them. And if you have this goal, sweetheart, it's stupendous. We can't guarantee we won't harm. But always, and that's how you create the virtuous karma in your mind, of guiding yourself in the right direction, of having the sincere wish not to harm, and you do your best. Sometimes it's quite difficult. It's impossible sometimes.
It's difficult.
We do our best, sweetheart.
Okay, my dog's suffering.
But you haven't tried hard enough to remove them.
No, I brush him, but I probably need to go through his little black coat.
No, you do.
And
this is, this is, might take hours, but this is where, you know, you can help your little dog stop suffering. I mean, fleas don't dig in like ticks, do they?
No. No, he hasn't got ticks.
And are there a million, a thousand? How many fleas are there? How many would there be? Can't you just sort of give the fleas something ugly so they run away but doesn't kill them?
Well, I've got a cat, but it's not jumping. They're not jumping on.
No, I mean, can't you find something that fleas don't like that you put on the dog that makes them go away, but they doesn't kill them? There has to be lots of things, darling.
Possibly.
Google it, and you will find many methods.
Okay.
My main point is this: in our culture, our scientific world, which is informed by the Christian teachings that God made all these creatures for our benefit, and that it's cool to kill them. That's our basis. That's the basis of our society. Then we don't make effort. We just think, oh well, kill it, or you know. But there's other methods, and so if you have this intention not to harm, because we're intelligent, we're going to find lots of methods to try not to kill, but to indeed help your dog. You know, get the fleas off, of course, nothing wrong. Get the mice out of your house, get the rats out, get the cockroaches out, but not to try and not
but
to
not
harm
not kill them.
We do our best, darling.
Yeah.
Sure. Got to make effort.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Microphone, please.
Can I ask the question?
Yeah, for sure. After this lady. Oh, you? No, you're there. I'm sorry, yeah, I didn't see you. Go for it, sweetheart.
Hello, Patrick.
Patrick.
How is a Buddha's mind dependent arising?
Okay, you've got to tell me what you think that means and why you even asked the question. So what do you think it means that makes you ask the question?
It means that the Buddha's mind's dependent on something.
So is Buddha's mind here, why you say Buddha's mind as opposed to your mind? Is there
or
a
my mind, yeah.
Okay, any mind, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, good. So how is mind independent arising? That's what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay, easy question now. Simple. Okay. So you have a mind, Patrick? You do?
Yeah.
So a Buddha would suggest that whatever exists is made up of parts.
Yeah.
So then would you agree your mind is made of parts?
Yeah.
Tell me the parts of your mind.
Thoughts.
There you go.
Contents.
Right there. That's how dependent arises.
Right.
Consciousness or mind exists in dependence upon all the various parts. So does Patrick. So does microphone. So does ring. So does ear. Everything that you posit as existing, whatever it might be, the action of a Rabina holding a cup, the action of killing a mouse, a thought, the mind in general, the nose, whatever exists necessarily is dependent upon causes and conditions first. And then second is dependent. It exists in dependence upon all its bits and pieces.
Right.
Mind the same.
I've read somewhere where it says a Buddha's mind is permanent.
Okay, I see. I now see what you're saying. Okay. Okay. The word permanent in Buddhist philosophy has got a different way of talking from how we talk. In general, things that exist in the universe are divided into permanent and impermanent. This is it. Now we're getting a bit abstract, but please try and hear it. All things that we know about, which is how we've been talking, are all impermanent, changing from moment to moment, produced by causes, you know, coming into being, going out of being. This is the general meaning of impermanent. So then impermanent is divided into gross impermanence and subtle impermanence. Gross impermanence is what's evident to our eyes. You see the flower wilting and die. You see, you get born and then die. Subtle impermanence is referring to the very fact of your mind coming into being, or your person, Patrick, coming into being. The very fact of Patrick's coming into being implies its cessation. You can't have coming into being without going out of being. It's more subtle, and it can only be cognized in deeper meditation, this so-called subtle impermanence. With me? Okay. So now, permanent then, for the Buddha, in general, would mean not what we think, lasting forever, but it has the specific meaning of not changing from moment to moment, not produced by causes. Right? So in general, all the phenomena in the world, like person, Buddha, love, hate, nose, I, Patrick, they're all dynamic, impermanent phenomena. But basically there are some phenomena, and this is a major point in Buddhist philosophy, that are said to exist. There are phenomena that do exist, but they don't change from moment to moment, and they're not produced by causes, which seems sort of abstract for us. But all it's referring to, and some people call them abstract, is the absence of something. So that's why they talk about permanent, to help us comprehend how emptiness, although it is a dynamic thing you have to realize, isn't an impermanent phenomenon. So it's not, I mean, it almost throws us by hearing it. But when we understand it in the context of the day-to-day studies of this stuff, it makes sense. So any phenomena, would you agree that white does exist on this cup? And white is an impermanent phenomenon. It changes from moment to moment. It's a dynamic. We can see it, taste it, touch it, feel it, yeah? They're all impermanent phenomena. But you also agree, don't you, that red doesn't exist on this cup? You agree with that? So we turn that into a phenomenon. Remember, we talked about a phenomenon. We would say the absence of red. So there is a phenomenon called the absence of red. Do you agree?
Yeah.
On this cup. So the absence of phenomenon is a phenomenon you can cognize, isn't it? But not with your eyes, can you? Because your eyes see white, you can deduce, because you're intelligent, that it's not red. So that abstract phenomenon called the absence of red, or in your mind right now, let's say there's no anger. So we can say that in this moment, there is in Patrick's mind the cessation of anger. Do you accept my point? That phenomenon called the cessation of anger, that phenomenon called the absence of red, that phenomenon called the absence of 10,000 pounds, that phenomenon called the absence of the inherent eye, they are said to be permanent phenomena. But it seems abstract to us hearing it now, but it is called that. So then, therefore, they talk about the mind of the Buddha. They talk about you've got consciousness, and then there's the emptiness of the mind of the Buddha. Well, the emptiness of the mind of the Buddha is permanent in this sense we're discussing. But mind itself is always impermanent. But you could argue using the ordinary term of permanent. You could, now using our view of permanent, which means last forever, definitely your mind is permanent in the sense that it's beginningless and endless. And once you've realized emptiness, you can never fall back to negativity. You can only go forward. So that's permanent. That can never change. So the happiness that we eventually can accomplish by removing all the delusions from the mind, using the word we understand, that state of happiness is permanent, meaning it won't ever change. But that's not how they use it normally in philosophy. In Buddhism. Do you see? Okay, good. Nearly lunch. Any more questions? Yes. Okay, that's right. Please pass this way.
My question is, how does Mahayana Buddhism view
yes.
acts of omission? So not doing things or saying things that if you'd said or done them might alleviate suffering of others? As opposed to concrete acts that come.
Would you just give me an example, please?
Not saying something to someone that might have helped them feel better or happier. A friend, not saying the thing that you think afterwards, I should have said that would have helped. Not doing something.
I understand. I mean, it, in a strict sense, you have to say, taking the view in Buddhism of what the label action means, the action has to be intentionally not killing, intentionally killing, intentionally being kind, or intentionally not being kind. And my sense is what you're suggesting is only afterwards you thought I could have said that. Well, that wasn't an action. It can't be in the technical sense. But you can learn from it because you're self-centered and you didn't think enough about that person. Then you can learn from it. But there's not really negative karma there. It can't be because karma means intention. There is something there because we are self-centered. You understand? But we can learn from it. But intention has to be conscious. I won't say that to her. That's when it's really a karmic imprint, you know. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
But we can learn from it. Of course it's selfish. We all like this.
Thank you
understand? Yeah. What else? Before lunch? Anything else? No. Yes. Yes? Okay, darling, grab the phone, grab the mic, darling. Here we go.
All right.
Go on, Jane.
Thank you.
Speak.
Hello. So if you do get to, if one gets to the point where you can, where the neuroses are removed, and you're saying you can't backslide.
At the point you've had the direct realization of emptiness, using those words, you can't backslide. You just no longer can backslide.
Even if that being incarnates again out of choice.
What, darling?
Even if that being incarnates again out of choice.
Sorry, what?
If it's a bodhisattva person, a person who said, okay, a person who's removed all the, who's removed all of those neuroses and has that perfect mind.
Well, okay, wait a minute, just for terminology. If you're a bodhisattva, you haven't got a perfect mind, you'd be a Buddha. But if you're a bodhisattva, you're on the way. So you're on the way.
Gotcha.
You know?
Okay, that's a distinction.
Removed a certain level of realization, a certain level of delusions, and if you've realized emptiness, you've removed the root of them. You can only move. You've still got more to go.
You can't fall back.
So
even if you go to the next lifetime, you start from where you ended.
Oh, God almighty, you'd be never ending if you didn't.
Okay, that's what I want.
That's like thinking you wake up tomorrow morning and all the piano you played today is gone.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be very depressing like that, wouldn't it?
Well, kind of is. That's why I'm asking.
But you know, in daily life, it's not like that, is it? You know, if you practice the piano, okay, if you leave it for 10 years, you'll forget it.
Right.
But if you keep practicing every day, you can only get better.
All right.
Of course. Oh, my God. It'd be hopeless if otherwise. Totally, there's no way to go if that were like that.
Right.
It would smash in the face of everything Buddha's saying.
Right, okay.
It'd be meaningless and dreadful, and you might as well kill yourself now.
That's what I want to say. Whew, what a relief. Okay.
Venerable?
Yeah. I'm eating all these strepsils. No, it's just strepsils, yeah. Yes.
So my question is, why do we perceive the world as separate from us, even in our dreams?
Please forgive me, darling, I can't hear.
Sorry, why do we see the world as separate from us, even from our dreams? Because our dreams...
Why does what?
Why?
Does.
Do we perceive the world as separate from us, even in our dreams?
Because of ego grasping.
Even in our dreams, because we create everything in our dreams.
Because of ego grasping.
So does it mean that you don't perceive the world as separate even in your dreams?
Because of ego grasping, the final thing to go is when you become a Buddha, that's when you no longer have the experience of subject-object permanently. Finally, then, there's no longer subject-object. Until the highest level of realizations, there's still always the appearance of subject-object, you and me, separate. That's the final delusion to be gone from the mind when you've achieved omniscience.
But is it something you experience every day, for instance?
As long as your mind exists, it's there. It might be quiet, might be latent, but it's there, informing all your experiences, including your dreams.
What is that, sorry?
I beg your pardon?
What is there?
Why?
What is there? You said something is there.
Ego grasping.
Ego grasping.
Ego grasping.
Okay, okay.
The root delusion. As long as it's in the mind, even in the subtlest of our dreams, there's still the experience of subject-object, you, me, dualism. Mm-hmm. It's just how it is. When you finally achieved omniscience, that has finally gone. Even the highest yogis, in their meditation, they have the experience of non-duality. But in their daily life, there's still the appearance of subject-object, but they don't buy into it. Okay. They don't buy
into it. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. 5 more minutes for lunch, I'm sorry. But you can go now and go to the toilet and everything, I suppose, can't you? We haven't done the practice yet. We haven't talked about the bodhisattva path yet. Oh, my goodness. So is there still something for people, just before you go? Are there things you're sort of kind of waiting for that haven't made certain things clear yet? I mean, there must be millions of things, but just say some things so we can make sure we cover them. Please, the microphone.
Mm-hmm. You said that ego grasping is like the instinct for survival.
Well, I just say that very loosely. I would suggest that what we experience when we have instinct for survival is a complete panic and fear, right? That's exactly what happens. That's what Buddha would call ego grasping. What's arising is this primordial delusion that clings to the self. Yes.
I mean, it relates to my question yesterday. It's kind of annoying me, this question. It's
good, go on.
Children need to be securely attached.
Okay, good. Back to your
develop.
Question. This is great. Now the good time for it. Come on. Perfect.
So, you know, it seems as though this need to attach is potentially a problem, and where the ego grasping comes from.
Darling. No, we've got to distinguish between virtue and not. Remember that virtue and non-virtue, good and bad states of mind. Yeah. Okay. First of all, let's take that. We'll take that point. That a child is born. Let's say a child is born. Any child is born. They could. Don't forget, they're coming with their past stuff.
Yeah.
So they could. Let's say there's a child got a lot of attachment, come from past life, and they come into this life with an immense bottomless pit of neediness. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kid who's going to scream and cry and get upset if mummy doesn't give him the breast when he wants it, who kicks and screams and demands, who's neurotic and upset and miserable. We know children like this. No, that's not being horrible about them, but they come with their strong neediness. And sometimes with some people, we can see human beings who began being babies, no matter how many people love them, no matter how many people praise them, no matter how many times you get stroked, they still like a vampire sucking your blood more. Do you recognize what I'm saying here? That's a delusion. That's attachment. That's a nightmare. That's the cause of that person's suffering. And that's going to completely pollute all their goodness as well and drive their poor mummy to distraction and make her think she's a terrible mother. You could have another person, and that mother might be a wonderful mother who pours love and kindness, but still this little person's dissatisfaction is so primordial, they're never enough. It's never enough. You get my point?
Yeah.
Now let's say you have another little person who's quite highly realized from being a little yogi in the past, who comes with virtually no attachment, delusion. And they have a lousy mother who doesn't give them much love and doesn't give much compassion, who whacks them around. That person won't suffer very badly at all. Not at all, because they don't have attachment. So when you can hear these two, then you can begin to understand. Of course, what we say in the West is what you're talking, and that's called love and connection. That's a virtue. It's marvelous.
Mm.
But if you've got the needy kid, you can love that child and hold it in your arms and feed it and give it $1,000 a day. It'll never get happy. So don't think that the poor mothers think, well, I'm not loving it enough, and all the poor therapists will accuse the mother. No, it's the poor kid's fault for having this bottomless bit of neediness and masses of rage and anger. But the little yogi kid, who's got love and compassion, even though his mother's an alcoholic and gives him no love and forgets to feed him, he won't get upset. He might get hungry, but he'll always have compassion for his mummy, and he'll become a marvelous human being. That's the Buddhist approach to it, which is a very different way of talking, you know? In other words, it suggests that the person brings something into this life. They're not just a product of the mother.
Mm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Of course we've got to give connection. We use the words attachment. That's called love and compassion in Buddhism. It's called kindness and affection and looking in the eye and, sweetheart, you're beautiful. Of course, darling, it's called kindness. It's fundamental. But you hear my point, though? We don't think this way in the Buddhism. We think that person's made by the child, by the mother. We think they're like an empty, like a blank slate. So if they're neurotic, it must be the mother's fault. I mean, it's cruel for the poor mother. Do you understand?
Yeah.
You know, I always think of those Columbine kids. Remember those Columbine kids years ago? I mean, it was the first, you know, big news about all these rampages in schools, and these kids, and they had these videos, and then there's these poor, suffering, demented, delusional minds these poor boys had. So naturally, the first thing everybody thinks, it's the parents. And you know what? All they could find was nice, quiet, innocent, good, Christian, white parents. They couldn't find a single mistake. And people get angry because they think it must be the parents. And the next time I remember reading another time that's similar, I was in the States at the time, this little six-year-old kid happened to be black, whose mum is a junkie, whose daddy's in prison. Well, that ticks all our boxes in the West. Oh, that's why he's the way he is, you know. Rubbish, it's too superficial. It's not factoring in the child, the person. We don't like, that's shocking to us. You understand? Yeah. I know different people who've got crazy parents but have really got, they're wholesome themselves. They don't suffer that much. This is shocking to us because you're saying the person's got their own mind. So, of course, you've got to nurture a person and enable the love and compassion to come out, you know. Of course, that's the job, but that's called compassion. Buddha wouldn't use the term attachment there. But in the worldly sense, of course, call it attachment if you like. But no, there's a difference, like flat, B flat and flat table. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Good.
Thanks.
All right. Time for lunch. Thank you, darling. So let's look at lunch differently. Let's see lunch as empty. So what this means is you go out there, you're kind of expecting lunch, if you attach to food, maybe most of us. We're kind of expecting something that we like, aren't we? So if you see something you don't like, you're going to be a nice Buddhist. You won't complain. But you won't be happy. I don't like that, you know. Well, that's too hot, or I don't like salad, or... But we'll be polite, we'll eat it. But that's delusion, that's attachment working. Attachment just didn't get what he wanted. So notice your mind when you see it. And then, of course, underneath that is the assumption that it's that from its own side. So try and, you know, before you shove it in mindlessly, let's do the extra little practice here. First see it as empty, and then imagine it's this delicious nectar, and we're going to just, here for 30 seconds, just imagine a couple of things. Put seeds in our mind. Imagine every being in the universe, all the holy ones, all the ordinary ones, all the suffering ones. And we imagine before we put it in our mouth, if we could, we would offer it to every single one. Just in that thought alone is so stupendous. You've sown such powerful seeds in your mind, just that thought, that now, as Lama Zopa says, you can... The bigger your stomach, the better. Okay? So we just bless and offer the food. Lama Sange Lama Chö, Deja Nama Gedonte, Kungi Jepo Lama Te, Lama Namla Chö Pabo. Please enjoy your lunch. Do your discussion again, do the trip we did yesterday, which is for those who weren't here, what we're going to do roughly. Yeah, okay. To three o'clock, lunch, and then grab a little group. Did it work, you say, talking to each other? Did it work? Discussion groups. Please have discussion groups. Little people. Three, four, and all go blah, blah. About what you've heard. Don't make up rubbish. And then ask questions.